thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 24 for the 8th of April, 2008, Running from the Law. I'm Dan Cohen. Welcome back to Digital Campus, and we're here with the regulars, Tom and Mills. Hi, Tom and Mills.
Hey, Dan.
Thought I'd introduce you all at once, since we got such excellent feedback from our listeners for the first anniversary podcast, episode 23, a couple of weeks ago, and they wanted us to try to keep the news a little bit shorter, perhaps, just a smidgen shorter.
And the hellos, so.
Right. Which I've already blown by being long-winded about discussing this introduction. But anyway, welcome to our audience, back to the Digital Campus podcast. Of course, we also patted ourselves on the back for not missing weeks over the past year, and then we went ahead and missed a week. I think we've all been doing a lot of traveling, and maybe we'll hear a little bit about some of our travels and some of the conferences we've gone to later in the podcast. But we did want to thank all the people who wrote in. There's some terrific comments on the podcast, which if you go to digitalcampus.tv and click on episode 23, that are really quite helpful. I think not only for us, Tom and Mills, but I think for a lot of academics who are thinking about doing a podcast, it really is a nice sort of overview of, I think, what people want. And luckily, they don't want to see us in video. Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, seriously.
And it seems the other things are, we're probably going to try to do a little upgrade on the audio. People seemed happy with the audio, but there's some things that we can fix, like leveling up the sound between all three of us and maybe getting slightly better mics. And I think another good request that several people mentioned that we're going to work on is breaking out the feature segments, which we try to make a little bit independent of, you know, the current events. And some of those discussions, like our very first discussion on Wikipedia, people keep coming back to, and so we could make it a separate segment that people can download using classes. So thanks again to everyone who posted to the blog, and we got a bunch of email as well. Thanks to all of our listeners, new and old. And let's dive right in. I don't know if the two of you realize this, but we are in the first state of the United States that has a mandated internet safety class starting in the fall. Mills, did you hear about this? You've got kids in the school system. And you've been spouting off about the dangers of that online world. Did you hear about this? It was just passed, I guess, over the weekend.
Yeah. Actually, we got through my older son's middle school. We got an email about it over the weekend, letting us know that this was going to start happening. And I'd heard from my kid's elementary school principal that, you know, it was in the works. And I have to say, with, you know, two children in, you know, one's in grade 3, one's in grade 6 in the Virginia public schools, as a parent, I'm quite happy that they're going to do this, because kids certainly spend a lot of time online, and increasingly assignments coming home from school require them to go to the internet to find answers to questions. And some of those internet spaces that they have to go to are collaborative spaces like Wikipedia or whatever. And so, you know, teaching children about internet safety, I think, is a very good component of an elementary, middle school, high school curriculum. I think by high school, they're probably feeling pretty jaded and don't want to hear about it, but certainly in the elementary school years and in the middle school years, where I think it gets tricky is then when schools are also blocked from having access to content that can be useful to the teachers. This comes up all the time with teacher training workshops that I do, where entire school districts block access to YouTube because of inappropriate content within the YouTube universe. So then suddenly teachers can't have access to YouTube at all without a special permission form that has to go all the way to the school board. So there's, you know, it's great that they're teaching the kids internet safety, but then I think there needs to be more of a conversation in the schools about how teachers get access to material that is appropriate without these sort of blanket thou shalt not pronouncements.
Yeah, it seems like this is a great if this is a replacement for blocking websites, this seems like the best way to go. If it seems like education is the way we should go and not prohibiting students from going to various sites that could be very useful to them if used correctly. I mean, I've tended to poo-poo this issue. I don't have kids, but actually reading the stories about this legislation, I was really actually pretty surprised to see that 4% of children between 10 and 17 had been asked for sexually explicit photos of themselves, which, I mean, actually is incredibly shocking to me. So while I have tended to not treat this as a big deal, I think maybe it is a much bigger deal than I've made it to be, and we probably education programs like this certainly can't hurt.
Well, and one more piece on this. One of the ways increasingly that younger children now interact with one another outside of school is through these massive online role playing games, and they're not like World of Warcraft or anything. They're Maple Story and things like that, where it's just, you know, silly little characters going around collecting things, but they are nevertheless massively multiple player games, and there's no control over who those players are, and there is the possibility of chatting with other people who are playing the game, and there's no way for children to know whether those people are, you know, 48-year-old sex offenders or 8-year-old friends from down the street.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I go back and forth on this issue. I've got twin 4-year-olds, and they're just starting to use the web, and so we're really, restricting them to SesameStreet.org and places like that. But they do click around a lot, and you kind of worry about it a little bit, even at a young age. It's really easy to, even on some of these, so-called safe sites, it's kids don't really realize what they're clicking on and sort of where they're going on the web. It's a very confusing medium compared to, let's say, TV, which is very one way. I do worry a little bit about the uses of these scare stories. Brian Alexander of Knightly, the technology and liberal education group, has a lot of these sort of scare stories on his blog. He likes to sort of catalog them and the way that they're used by legislators to sort of pass things through. And I guess there was another one over the weekend with the blogging kills you story that made a lot of hay over at the New York Times. If you go to newyorktimes.com, I think it's the most emailed story of the week about bloggers keeling over from working too hard. I don't know about the two of you, but my blog hasn't killed me yet.
I'm hanging in there so far.
Right. But, this is the media, there's a certain sensationalism that tends to go along with the internet that you wouldn't think about if, let's say, a novelist keeled over, right, finishing their great novel, right. Which I'm sure has probably happened. Having said that, I think Mills, your point is really the critical one that, this is probably the kind of legislation that will be reproduced, I think, a lot. And, I think it's relatively benign. I mean, sure, I'd love my kids to get sort of little education classes when they're 10 and starting to branch out on the web, which inevitably they will do. And I think there's an interesting parallel in higher ed. I mean, when you have universities that are blocking certain ports or certain file types that have both good and bad uses. There's the China or Pakistan method, which is, you block all BitTorrent or you block all of a specific service because it does have possibly negative uses. Or, you worked something a little bit more, work on something a little bit more subtle. And I think that's really the big tension is which way it will go between these two poles of something that's more education and subtlety versus the massive technological firewall solution of just shutting something down. I'm sure there are school districts that do that as well.
Oh, I'm sure.
Well, the other story that we saw that we've been covering a lot on the podcast caught our eye is that Google Docs, which you know, we've been sort of touting as a, you know, possible replacement for Microsoft Word. It's certainly not there yet, but, you know, it doesn't have things like footnotes and some of the formatting requirements. But, you know, not bad. And we've got students using it. But the major criticism of Google Docs is that you couldn't take it offline. And over the last week, actually, bizarrely, on April 1st, which is generally a day that Google likes to sort of make fun rather than make news, they released an offline version of Google Docs. And I don't have the two of you played around with this? It actually works pretty well.
It actually, they haven't released it for everybody. They're rolling it out slowly. So I don't have it in my, as one of my options yet. I don't actually have the offline button, there yet. So I don't think
have you used Google Gears, which is the kind of, downloadable client? Yeah.
I've got Google Gears and I've got it and it, you know, I use it with my Google Reader, but, they haven't rolled it out to me yet for my Google Docs. So it actually hasn't made it, I think, all the way down into their entire user base. So I unfortunately haven't been able to play with it.
I don't have it either yet.
Right. So you know, it's not just that, it's that they've also upgraded the interface and it's looking more and more Word 4.1 like every day, which I think is a plus if you remember.
And
back
that I have. That I
the,
have.
Right. So. To the halcyon days of Word 4.1 before Word got far too complicated for anyone but a rocket scientist with all the options that they had in the menu. You know, it's a very usable sort of document setup now. I think, you know, there are some tricky parts in that internally here at the Center for History and New Media, we use it a lot for collaboration. And when you're not, if you're using it in the offline mode, you're making all these edits. I kind of wonder about when you get back online how it's going to do conflict resolution, which is always a huge problem. It's a big problem that we're dealing with on a couple of our software projects where we do have collaboration and synchronization. Mm-hmm. You always worry about, you know, what if several of us go offline and make lots of edits? How do you resolve and come up with a, you know, the next version of that document? So I can see that being a big problem, but I think for individual use, it's really a big step forward, and I think we'll, you know, possibly get past a lot of the concerns that universities have, or are those concerns more about privacy and the fact that Google's got your docs?
Yeah, I'm not sure what those concerns are about. I think that there's just a kind of institutional investment in desktop software, and that there's a there's a certain amount of honestly, career insecurity among certain people where they've invested a career in learning how to support these programs, and then something like Google Docs comes along that's like really lightweight, really simple, free. And if you're using Google Apps for business, they provide support. They provide a support mechanism, a 1-800 number that you can call for support. And so I think a lot of it has to do with just kind of institutional resistance and professional insecurity. I think that's kind of harsh, but I think it's actually true.
Yeah, I would agree with Tom on that. I think that's really the main thing.
Okay. Well, we'll have to keep track of this. I mean, I wish there were some stats on how many. I guess there's Google Apps for business, but then isn't there a separate unit of Google that's just for education, or they're selling it as a Google Apps for Ed, where you get the email, so we could have a @gmu.edu domain, et cetera, just as you can in business. Isn't that right, Tom?
Yeah, I think they have a kind of variation on their business package, which is for education, and I think there it has to do with, I think it's more of a marketing thing, and maybe a difference in the kind of support they provide rather than the essential feature set being any different. So, but I think I do think we need to keep an eye on this, and we'll see where it goes. I'll be happy when they give me my downloadable version.
Right. I can never figure out how all these services decide who to roll it out to first.
It's so weird because I got the Facebook chat.
Yeah, I got that too. I got the Facebook chat
yesterday.
Right.
And I was on Twitter with a bunch of people, and everybody else said, no, I don't have it yet. So it's weird. Yeah, how do they decide? Maybe it's like heavy users, or I don't know what it is, but maybe it's alphabetical. Who knows?
Right. Well, I haven't used Facebook chat, and I doubt I will. So, but I am glad I got the Google thing. Thank you. Well, today is a very special day in the history of open access to scholarly and research content, at least in the United States. We're recording this on April 7th, 2008, and as of today, all articles, scientific articles, arising from funds that are grant funds from the National Institutes of Health, which for those of us, for those of you in the audience from in our international audience, NIH funds a great deal of sort of basic research, and really a lot of the major academic research labs in the United States are either solely or mostly funded by grants from NIH and NSF as well, of course, for hard sciences, physics and math and things like that. But there is a site that's been up for a while called PubMed Central. And as of today, all articles that arise from NIH funds have to be submitted to PubMed Central to be published and made accepted. And then all these articles in turn are available at pubmedcentral.nih.gov. And so the public, any researcher can access sort of all the fruits of all these taxpayer dollars and the research that is based upon them. And interestingly, sort of as we saw this open up, you know, we're big fans of open access here, but we've noticed here in the Academy that it's becoming harder and harder to figure out, you know, what you can really do with materials. And so, interestingly, over the weekend, someone asked on Peter Suber's blog on open access, his terrific open access blog, which I'll link to from digitalcampus.tv. You know, there was a researcher saying, well, they had tried to go to PubMed Central and use an automated process to download a bunch of articles and to do some text mining and analysis of those articles, and realized that it their server process was blocked, and looked at the terms of service for PubMed Central and realized, well, wait a second, it's not quite as open as they expected, that you indeed can't do this kind of automated or machine reading of the PubMed articles. You can read them as a human being, one at a time. And so there's a lot of questions as we sort of expand out the circle of this discussion, where we as professors kind of never are quite sure, and I think it's becoming more and more challenging in the digital age to figure out, you know, what we can do with materials. I think it's one of the reasons that the Creative Commons movement and licensing has become very popular, because, you know, it spells out a little bit more clearly and provides a lot more flexible options for the ways that, you know, certainly non-commercial users, and in some cases commercial users, can make use of text and images and these sorts of things. So we thought we'd start just with a story from the three of us. Mills, you actually were trying to figure out recently in this gray area of what you can do with openly accessible materials, you know, what you can do with them in an educational sphere and beyond that, since you're actually posting this stuff on the web. Do you want to talk about your experience, and we'll springboard off of that?
Yeah, it was actually kind of an interesting moment, because I'm working on this big NIH-funded web project on the end of communism in Eastern Europe, and one of the sources that we've included in the project is a video that we got out of YouTube, and it's kind of a crucial moment in the end of communism, and that is in early November 1989, the press spokesman for the East German Communist Party misspeaks at a press conference and is then willfully misconstrued by West German television to be saying that anybody in East Germany can travel to West Germany without a visa, which is not the case. The West German news actually leads with the story, "The wall is open," which it wasn't. Wow. But everybody watching the news that night in both East Berlin and West Berlin thought, wow, the wall is open. And so hundreds of thousands of people converge on the wall and then tear it down that night. And so it's this, you know, sort of signature moment in the history of Eastern Europe. Well, that press conference, or the news coverage of that press conference, was in YouTube. And I've used it in my classes, and it works really well, because you see this guy, this sort of gray East German communist bureaucrat, say, you know, just you can see the moment where he doesn't know the answer to the question, and so he just makes one up, and it turns out to have been the wrong thing to say. And the students they don't understand the German, most of them, but they can see what's happening as I'm translating for them in class. And so they can see how this actually occurs. And it's a much more powerful moment visually than it is to just lecture about it. So I was really happy to find this video in YouTube more than a year ago. So recently we were working on our 1989 project, and we went back to the page in YouTube where the video was, and it said, there's a little note that says it's been taken down because of a complaint from an archive in Germany which claims to have the rights to this particular clip of that news conference. And so, you know, whether they actually do have the rights and whether under EU law or not they can force YouTube to take it down, and whether YouTube is just complying rather than have any sort of problem with them, I have no idea. But as a faculty member, all of a sudden, wow, this video that I needed is gone. And so, you know, an important, for me, what had become an important part of a signature lecture that I give in a course is gone. But also, as somebody running an educational project for students and teachers, now that's also gone. So, you know, all of a sudden I have to be a copyright expert.
Right. And right. So we need to, we've always had copyright classes in the academy, and usually taught by a librarian, and these tended to focus on, you know, printed materials, and there were some hard and fast rules, like books before 1923 are okay to republish, etc. And there were some gray areas. I mean, it's very hard to often know about books between 1923 and 1960. Some of them didn't have their copyrights renewed or whatever, but there were some rules that you could kind of make your way through, at least in the United States. And I'll actually link to a good chart that we have here at the Center for History and New Media about resources and sort of getting a vague sense of what you can do with them. Mills, I mean, you bring this up very, very vividly. You know, the online resources, I assume that not only do we need to know this traditional copyright law, but now that takedown notice was done under the DMCA, this American law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which very seriously sort of reshaped the nature of copyright online and made it easy, for instance, for clearly some entity, I assume, this former Eastern European network or institution, which has probably been rolled up into some corporation, to send Google a notice to take down this video on YouTube. And there's no legal process in this DMCA takedown notices. You just send a notice, and I think it has to be brought offline if it's a reasonable request. And then we can sort of make our way out from there about all the new digital stuff that's online and how we sort of have to deal with all these legal questions. Let's expand out a little bit more. One story that we saw from a couple of weeks ago is that Elsevier, the very large publisher of science, technology, and medicine journals, sort of agreed with MIT to allow MIT to use, I think it's up to 100 words of some of their articles on their open courseware site. And
three illustrations.
And three illustrations, right. And, here's a case where here's a university that's trying to make, they're publishing, I think it's something like 400 courses a year online. I mean, they've got a lot of old courses as well. And here they're dealing with this tremendous, how do you look across the copyright landscape to think about what to do with this? And a lot of these lectures that they're posting online have bits of, they might have Tom, you were saying, a few of these important graphs, let's say, from a physics article. And I was really shocked at this. Mills, you sort of instantly, I think, instant messaged me about this. I think it's actually more complicated than the original story. Tom, go ahead.
Yeah, I just think it's sort of interesting that there's this big announcement that Elsevier is going to let MIT use these 100-word excerpts from journals. It's 100 words per journal per course, I believe. And I think that probably most professors who have been putting their courses online through MIT's open courseware probably thought that 100 words of text from a journal was fair use anyway. I'm sure they were doing it anyway, possibly more than 100 words. And so this announcement, almost, while it was sort of billed as Elsevier opens up, in some ways it's like Elsevier cracks down, because I'm sure this is going to actually not expand the practice, but actually limit the practice that's already been going on.
Well, the complication with MIT is, and I totally agree, Tom. I mean, I thought, well, this is certainly under the principles of fair use. And there are four rules of fair use. I mean, part of the problem Mills, as we discussed, the video that you wanted to grab and post to our site is, you know, video, very complicated. I mean, what is the correct amount of fair use? When Roy Rosenzweig and Josh Brown and Steve Breyer were publishing their CD-ROM on American history, they wanted to use some very, very short clips from Disney. And the Disney Corporation said, no way, you know, not even one frame. It's not, you know, they won't allow that under, you know, we'll sue you. And so fair use for them was, you know, not even a single frame, 1/24th or 1/30th of a second of a movie. And so it's hard to know in that span. But, you know, oftentimes, and I think you had mentioned this to me, Mills, is you said, well, isn't it 10%? Isn't 10% okay? And there just aren't these sort of hard and fast rules for text, but for video as well. The complicating factor in the MIT case was that they release open courseware under a Creative Commons license. So here we've got this very complicated legal landscape where they're making their lectures and lecture notes and course materials available under a Creative Commons license, which allows for reuse. And so even though their professors are using this 100 words in I think a very legitimately fair use way, they're worried about the downstream uses of that. So all of a sudden, the copyright landscape is very complicated, right? You need to think about when you post something online, you might be using it in fair use in your class. But what about someone who grabs it from your blog or from your open courseware site and reuses it again? They might be violating copyright in some way. And this is without even getting into the U.S. versus international landscape.
Right.
I took four courses about this in my PhD program, just like the rest of you did. So I'm really expert on this.
Right. Right. We all need our own sort of in-house general counsels to discuss it. And then on the other side is we're people who give away our stuff. We give away this podcast. We give away all of our course materials. But then, you know, our sort of eyebrows were raised when we heard this story on, I think it was on the Wired the Wired blog about a University of Florida professor, Michael Moulton, who has actually copyrighted his lectures and is suing someone who is trying to sell their notes.
Not just someone, one of his students.
One of his students, yes. Well, one of his students actually sold their notes to a corporation. I think it's called Einstein's Notes, and they sell these study kits for classes. And so they had, you know, sort of an embedded student taking notes. And, we probably wouldn't care. But this professor actually has, you know, I mean, copyright normally just is a default mechanism in the United States, which is why Creative Commons is such an important tool. Because, you know, if you, let's say, publish something on your blog, you don't have to actually go to the copyright office and get copyright on it. You automatically get copyright on it. But there are stronger penalties if you do go through the process of officially copywriting something, sending in a copy to the Library of Congress, et cetera, putting a C with a circle around it and saying all rights reserved, et cetera. You can then sue for more money and these sorts of things that lawyers care about. Well, this guy, this professor, actually went through the process to copyright his lectures, I guess because he would like to sell them with another company. And so here's a student, and you wonder about the other students in the classroom. Can they take notes? Could they share those notes, let's say, on Facebook, as we talked about, I think, on DC 22 or 23? How are we supposed to make our way in this world?
Well, you know, this I read about this morning, and I thought, oh my God, this is just nuts. Because first of all, I can't believe that his employer, the University of Florida, is allowing this situation to go forward. Because in Virginia and in most states that I'm familiar with, I mean, maybe Florida law is different, but teaching by state employees, which he is considered work made for hire. And so his lectures belong to the state, at least in Virginia. My lectures belong to the state of Virginia because I'm a state employee getting paid a salary by the state, by the taxpayers. And so my teaching belongs to the state. My research belongs to me. And so, I can copyright my research. I can't copyright my teaching. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is, this is all that's really happened here in terms of what the student did is to go with a third party intermediary, because, I mean, I have a number of friends who are physicians, and that's the way medical education has worked for years, is that the students, after the first semester, med students organize into study groups, and then they send one representative to class to take notes, and then that representative brings the notes back to the study groups. But they also often buy from other people who are note takers, who are med students, those study notes, and then they kind of combine them all together in their study groups. And certain students are really good note takers, and they help pay for their medical education by selling their lecture notes. And so this has been going on in med school, law school for a very long time. And I think that, so there's sort of two things going on here. One, this professor is trying to cash in on work made for hire. And so I think he's got a losing case in court, and it's just getting suckered by his lawyers. And number two, I think the courts are going to look at some sort of a precedent. This is a behavior that's been happening forever.
I think too that things like Creative Commons and stuff, in some ways, just sort of enshrines the obvious, which is that most things that are produced, most creative work, is not in the end marketable anyway. I mean, it's like we might as well sort of put a Creative Commons stamp on like this podcast, for instance, because really no one's willing to pay for it. I mean, and we could go through a lot of time and energy and hassle to try to get some contract with a publisher to publish this podcast, and we could hire a lawyer to write the copyrights for us and to protect us from infringements, or we could just give it away. And so in some respects, all of these fights are a lot of, it seems to me like a lot of wasted energy, and that's where I think Creative Commons and other free copyright licenses and things have just saved people a lot of work and taken a lot of work away from lawyers, I guess.
Yeah, we'll have to do a perhaps a future story on the various open source licenses, although that may put our audience to sleep at some point. But I do suppose, as we think about these questions of just sticking with academic content for a while, you really realize that, why in the software world, licenses like the GPL, the GNU General Public License that really kicked off the open source software movement, they're trying to solve these problems all in one fell swoop, right? I mean, they're trying to say, put a landscape in place that people don't get or make it really impossible to get sued for contributing or to reuse, to really clarify the ways in which when you really want something to be open and free, to make sure that it stays that way and to make sure that new laws and new kind of restrictions don't come along and completely wall something off or make it inaccessible. And, the software world has dealt with this, 15 or 20 years ahead of the content world. And that's where, I think Creative Commons is really just in its infancy. I mean, on campus, you don't really hear a lot of people talking about it. But, I don't think professors have really thought through these issues of, what they want to be free and how they can make something completely free forever or allow it for reuse. It really becomes very complicated on figuring that out. And then, if you think about if we were here at George Mason to set up an open courseware installation, we'd really need to think through, what can we put up there? I mean, what would you have to kind of vet all the lectures for internally copyrighted materials that you couldn't then repost on an open courseware site? It really becomes complicated when you think about it. Just one last thing that we've thrown in here, and perhaps this is a topic for another day, but we've been covering the patent landscape as well, and we'll have to come back to Blackboard's patents finally getting a negative ruling. The patent office rejected all 44 claims of Blackboard's patents for online learning software. But here at the center, and I think in general for places that are producing not only content, but we also often produce tools that sit on top of the content. We have generalized tools like Omeka and Zotero, but we also have you know, some tools that are specific to, let's say, annotation tools that are specific to a particular website or project. And we live in constant fear not only of the copyright issue and takedown notices for some of the content, but also some of these tools that might have features that, you know, for instance, Blackboard says they've patented. It's incredibly complicated. You know, just the one story that I'll tell on this end, a very short one, is that I had written some software many years ago that was a kind of precursor to Zotero. And as soon as I wrote it, the legal office here at George Mason, you know, sort of came over to my office and said, well, let's sit down and, you know, write up a patent request for this or file a patent on it. And so, you know, I was a little skeptical, but I just went with it for a little while, and I hadn't been at George Mason that long. And after about a month, they came back to me with this long legal document that said, that was completely incomprehensible. I mean, it was, you know, saying that I had created a tool that allowed for, you know, it was very much like these Blackboard patents, you know, for learning across wires between two machines that are up, that are operated by human beings. And you know, once you get into the patent world, you realize that this is what's going on. But this is another area that I think certainly for digital humanities centers, you know, we live in fear of these kinds of lawsuits for very generalized patents. I mean, Tom, you must be worried about that on Omeka.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of content management systems that we could be violating patents of. Who knows? They're written so broadly that it's impossible to even do a patent search and to figure out what patents you might be in violation of. We could run up against content management system patents. We could run up against collections management system patents. I'm sure there are those in the museum world. Yeah, it's a little worrying. You know, we have another project here that our colleagues over at that podcast are working on called Scholar Press, and it is designed to be a set of plugins for the WordPress blogging platform that in some ways replicates or substitutes for functionality that you might find in something like Blackboard or WebCT. And you know, who knows what patents are out on those kinds of functions. I don't think we're in violation of anything, but I'm sure if Blackboard's lawyers caught wind of it, they would be unimpressed. So it's very difficult to tell. I think, you know, for now, the Blackboard's patents have been rejected for this e-learning software. But I think that's just one step in this process. I think
this will
go on and on, and there will be reviews of reviews, and I think it remains to be seen whether these patents will be upheld. So,
Mills, what do you think the solution is on this? I mean, so that and I'm seeing the title of this episode, Running from the Law. How, you know, academia, you know, professors, students, you know, they're not used to thinking about these things. As you said, we've had to sit through our basic copyright classes, which are now grossly out of date. I mean, certainly they wouldn't have discussed broad software patents in the past that you might now encounter if you wanted to create an online tool. I mean, is it just more education? Is it copyright advocacy by universities, by libraries, by museums? What do you think is the long-term solution for this so we don't have to think as much as we currently do about these various issues?
I think it's going to be three things. I think it's the two that you mentioned, sort of more education of faculty members in this more complex legal landscape. The second is going to be more advocacy. And the third is just going to be more sort of grassroots so sue me behavior from faculty members who say, you know what, I'm using this for the purposes of education. I am not damaging the profitability of any corporation by doing this. I'm providing a public good, which is the education of children or adults. And as long as I'm not damaging the profitability of the copyright holder and providing a public good, then sue me.
And frankly, I'm not making any money on it. So
that's right. I'm not making.
So go ahead and sue me for my profits, which are zero.
That's right. And the you know, I can say that because I work for the state of Virginia, and so I'm clearly providing a public good for the taxpayers of Virginia. And if somebody decided to sue me, you know, like if I showed a clip from a Disney film in my class and the Disney Corporation decided to sue me, they're not really suing me personally. They're suing the George Mason University and the Commonwealth of Virginia. And that's a whole different hairball. But and I'm not just sitting here advocating embroiling my university in a lawsuit, but I am saying, it's going to be hard to win a jury trial. It's going to be hard for Disney to win a jury trial when I used a 30-second clip of an old Mickey Mouse cartoon to educate children.
Right. Well, I mean, but then doesn't that say that really where this hurts is for independent scholars who aren't part of a massive institution like George Mason, which is indeed a part of the sovereign Commonwealth of Virginia. But it, I think of the independent scholar who wants to put up a history website and might want to use materials where they're not really sure and can very easily get threatening cease and desist letters or...
they get one and they can't afford to hire a lawyer to do anything about it. So right. There is going to be a real chilling effect there. And that's, I think it's going to be 10 years before this all gets shaken out.
Yeah. And Tom, on your end, I can think about, beyond independent scholars, the work that you've done with, small museums and historic sites and libraries, that don't have a lot of funds to pursue a lawsuit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's they really do need to be educated on this. I was just at a meeting over the weekend in Florida where we were talking about issues of an IMLS-sponsored meeting, talking about issues of joint concern to archives, museums, and libraries. And I think this copyright issue is definitely one of those issues that we need to be training our library schools, archive schools, and museum studies programs need to be training their people in copyright, because at a small institution, if you come out of a museum studies program and you end up at a small institution with two or three or four employees and no general counsel, which is most museums, certainly museums and most libraries, the person with the museum studies degree or the library science degree, that person needs to know about this. And it's just the burden is just going to get higher.
Time once again for Picks of the Week. Mills, why don't we start with you?
All right. Well, mine is actually an iTunes U site, but it's the iTunes U site for the Holocaust Memorial Museum here in Washington. And I don't know, I'm pretty parochial about these kinds of things with regards to museums, so I don't know how many museums are using the iTunes U platform, but the Holocaust Museum has put up a really nice site through iTunes, which in particular includes a lot of lectures that have been given at the museum. They have an ongoing lecture series, and so now you can download the audio of those lectures through the iTunes U site as podcasts. And so that's a really nice resource. I've already got four of them pulled aside for lectures that I'm using in my class as supporting materials. And so all you have to have is the iTunes platform to have access to it. So I think it's a very nice resource for teachers and students.
Wow, that sounds great. I hadn't heard of that. Terrific. Okay. Tom, what do you have for us for this podcast?
I've got another blog, actually, a blog and podcast rolled into one called Hack College at www.hackcollege.com. It's a blog. I'll read the description very, very briefly. Hack College is a life hacking blog made for and maintained by college students. You want to work smarter, not harder. The idea is to provide information to college students about the kinds of tools, technologies, workflows that they need to use on the modern college campus. It's written, as it says, by college students, and they do a really great job. A guy named Kelly Sutton in particular is a fantastic writer. He's actually, I saw from his Twitter feed that he's going to be working at Revision 3 this summer, which is Kevin Rose's web broadcasting venture. And so it's a really talented crew there. There's four or five different bloggers. And they do great things like how to outfit your school newspaper with a live reporting system. So using the Nokia N95 multimedia handheld to make your college newspaper better and richer. So they do a lot of really cool stuff. It's very well written and a lot of fun. So I encourage people to subscribe there to see kind of the same issues we discuss here on Digital Campus, but from the student's point of view.
Great recommendation. Well, thanks very much. Well, I want to recommend just something that was, I think, related to our feature story, and that is going to encourage everyone who listens to the podcast to run over to capetowndeclaration.org. This is an open education declaration which is convened in Cape Town in September of 2007. There was a meeting there to basically to promote open access to educational materials, technologies, resources, teaching practices. And they came up with just a basic statement of principle, which has been translated into a number of different languages. And so if you are fed up, like we are, with a lot of the closed restrictions that copyrights and the legal landscape that patent threats have caused in the educational realm, you can go and sign the declaration. And it kind of provides some, I think, overall, sense of, you know, where we should move forward, as Mills said, in the next 10 years of what would kind of create a better, more open environment for learning and teaching. And I've gone ahead and signed it, and I encourage our audience to join people. And you can actually do it as an institution too. You can view it as, you can sign it as a group or individually.
And it takes no time. I just did it in the time you were speaking, Dan.
Right.
So.
Yep. You just read it, put your name down, say, talk about your affiliation, and that's it. You're done. Great. Well, thanks, Tom, for adding your name. And we will hear from all of you on our digitalcampus.tv site. And thanks again for all of your responses to Digital Campus 23. Hope you do the same on this week's episode. And we'll talk again in 2 weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not.